Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Thank you very much, everybody. It's a great honor to have the Crown Prince with us. Saudi Arabia has been a very great friend and a big purchaser of equipment and lots of other things. And
Kushner and MBS had never even met until before the inauguration.
The prince is saying, I have Kushner in my pocket because
Jared Kushner aided me in this crackdown.
Jared kind of looked at Saudi Arabia and said, and the guy who's going to save Saudi Arabia is Mohammed bin Salman.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who isn't a target, only a subject, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. So remember the president's first foreign trip to Saudi Arabia way back in May 2017?
Some pretty powerful visuals here as our president is escorted by black and white horses carrying U.S. and Saudi Arabian flags. I mean, this is pomp and circumstance, as you would presume in Riyadh, as big as it gets. And as I said
earlier, all the pageantry, that sword dance when Trump sort of shimmied around to the Bedouin drumming, the Saudi king hanging a huge gold medallion around his neck, Trump liked that, and there was Trump basking in the ghoulish light of a glowing orb. Well, that trip was the product of a curious friendship between Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, and Jared Kushner, the Jewish-American prince. Jared and MBS are BFFs, bonding over their shared hostility toward Iran, the unappreciated hardships of inherited wealth, and just being cool 30-something dudes remaking the Middle East from scratch.
All right, well, let's talk about it.
Well, my guest today has gone deep into the MBS-JK relationship. He writes that it brought the Gulf of Arabia to the brink of war 2 weeks after Trump's visit. Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker is here with me in the studio. Dexter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I found this completely fascinating. I mean, you go right into this sort of labyrinth of Mideast politics and its many strange points of connection to the Trump administration. But just for, you know, readers who may be as ignorant as I was before I read the piece, can you give us a little background on who MBS is, why he's important?
Well, the place to start in Saudi Arabia is with King Abdulaziz, or Ibn Saud, as they call him. He's the father of modern Saudi Arabia. He unified the kingdom in 1932. He died in 1953, and he had something like 44 sons and 55 daughters. But he essentially—
Oh, but just one wife, right?
he essentially decreed that he would be succeeded by his sons, one after the other. Not all of them, of course, but so I think it's seven sons have ruled consecutively since his death in 1953. And so as we sort of neared the end of the line of his sons, the tensions grew among his hundreds of grandsons, which one was going to get to be first crown prince and then king.
I mean, that's a Game of Thrones. Jesus, there are more than 100 grandsons, right?
Way more than 100. Yeah, yeah.
Hundreds.
And, yeah, and they all, at least notionally, have a claim to the throne. And so sort of who was going to get the prize? And so it was kind of a, you know, most of it took place behind the scenes, but it was a pretty intense scramble.
And I think we now know that MBS is the one who ended up on top. How did he win?
Well, he was his father's favorite, his father being the king, King Salman. So in a way, it wasn't predetermined at all. In fact, there is one more son, one more of Abdulaziz's sons. His name is Mukran. And he was, when King Salman became king, he originally named Mukran as the crown prince. After about a year, he got him out of there, just shipped him out, and brought in somebody else, Mohammed bin Nayef, who I refer to in the piece to as MBN. And there's a lot of alphabets here. But essentially it was King Salman, who's still the king, well over 80 years old, maneuvering, essentially putting his son, trying to get his son into the pole position.
And so MBS has been, since he came to power, came to the pole position, I think a little over a year ago, has been lauded as a modernizer. He's pro-Western in certain ways. I think he's decreed, can he just decree that women can now drive in Saudi Arabia? He has friends in Silicon Valley. Tom Friedman writes columns about how great he is. He's taking on the Islamists. I mean, do you buy that view of him?
You know, kind of half and half. And I think there had been so much unbridled enthusiasm for him and cheerleading in the Western press that it made me wonder if there was kind of another side to him, which in fact there was, in which I was able to find. But he's impressive. He's 32 years old. He's tall. He's gregarious. He's charismatic. He's ambitious. He's impatient. And I think he's confronting the central fact of Saudi Arabia right now, which is that the state that they have built is unsustainable, and they're going to run out of money. As somebody who was on the National Security Council told me, in 5 to 7 years, Saudi Arabia is broke. Because the welfare state is, you know, immense and incredibly generous. Everything is subsidized. But all that was built on the idea that oil would be expensive, you know, that it would be $100 a barrel, and it's like $60 a barrel now. So somebody's got to come in and save the monarchy or try to turn this big aircraft carrier in another direction, because if they don't do that, they're going to run into really severe problems very soon.
So he's thinking long term about exactly this problem. How do you have a Saudi Arabia run by the House of Saud without oil, or without oil being having the value it's had in the past? And he seems to be taking on this corruption and decadence in the royal family. I mean, he locked all these people who I guess are his relatives up in the Ritz Hotel, which was kind of hilarious, but probably not so funny if you were one of them being locked up there. But at the same time, he seems to, in other ways, exemplify this decadence and corruption.
Yes, yes. I mean, absolutely. He, on one hand, is trying to reform the economy, open it up. He's trying to reform the culture. He's letting women drive. He wants women to come into the workplace and have a more active role in society. He's kind of handcuffing the really conservative clerics. The one thing he's not doing is talking about political reform. This entire project is intended to save the House of Saud and to keep the House of Saud in power indefinitely. So there's no talk of democracy on the table.
And his best bud in the United States is Jared Kushner.
Amazing.
They seem to have formed a kind of relationship. Kushner has been back and forth many times to Saudi Arabia, probably responsible for Trump making his first foreign trip there to this Islamic summit thing they had. What's going on with that alliance?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, the story behind it is amazing. They had Kushner and MBS had never even met until before the inauguration. And a couple people, including Steve Bannon, described for me like how it all came about. And they said, literally, we got a map out of the Middle East. We kind of unrolled it on the table and we looked at it. It's a disaster. The Middle East is on fire everywhere. Iran is on the march. Lebanon is lost to the Iranians. Iraq is lost to the Iranians. Syria is lost to the Iranians. What do we have? You know, and they said our two pillars are Israel and Saudi Arabia. So we are going to do everything we can to strengthen those two. And then within that, Jared kind of looked at Saudi Arabia and said, and the guy who's going to save Saudi Arabia is Mohammed bin Salman and MBS, the young prince, not unlike Jared himself. And he's going to be the change agent is what they called him. And so at the time, MBS was not the crown prince. He wasn't in the pole position. He was the deputy crown prince. And so there was a very, again, quiet but intense rivalry going on between MBS and the man who was the crown prince at the time, Mohammed bin Nayef. And so there began this intense struggle into which I think it's fair to say that the Trump administration inserted itself directly to try to influence events and essentially make MBS and to ensure that he becomes crown prince. So it's a pretty intense Short period of time, but very intense.
But there are other players in the Trump administration at various stages, Tillerson, intelligence agencies, who don't think it's necessarily such a good idea to get in bed with MBS because, you know, this could come out a number of ways and the United States has to deal with whoever runs Saudi Arabia. And there's also this Saudi-Qatari conflict. Explain that a little bit, because there's just been these, I mean, one of the things I love about your story, Dexter, is all these what the hell stories I've been reading in the paper that you just can't understand it. You create a context and explain, at least in a very plausible theory, what that might have been about. But why did Saudi Arabia blockade Qatar? Do you say Qatar or Qatar? I never know.
I say Qatar, but yeah, there's gutter, Qatar, Qatar. But I know when you stand back and look at the map now, it's MBS has tried to overthrow the government in Lebanon. He's bombing Yemen, and he tried to overthrow the government in Qatar. And this was not long after the Riyadh summit, not coincidentally, I think.
So it's right. So Trump goes to Saudi Arabia, and 2 weeks later, Saudi Arabia announces this blockade. And essentially, it looks like there's going to be a war with Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi, the United Arab Emirates, on one side, and Qatar on the other.
Yeah, and Qatar's this like really strange place. It's super small. You land at the airport. It looks like Boca Raton. they're sitting on this.
Not as many Jews.
Not as many Jews. They're sitting on like this kind of infinitely large natural gas field. And so they're so fantastically wealthy. I think their sovereign wealth fund has $300 billion in it. And it's like they literally have to come to New York every year to kind of search for places to invest it. But among the things they spend their money on is Al Jazeera, which drives the Saudi and Emirati monarchies crazy because they're always criticizing them. They spend their money on the Muslim Brotherhood all across the Middle East. And so they're like troublemakers, and they just, you know, they're a tiny country with tons of money, and they're just stirring it up everywhere. And so the Saudis and also the Emiratis, they've been wanting to go after Qatar for years. And somebody in the Obama administration said to me, everything you're seeing happening right now, they wanted to do when we were in power, but we were basically holding them back. And so now it's essentially when Trump and Jared came in, they empowered him.
They gave him a green light. And how do you think that actually happened? You think this is part of Jared's bright idea? I mean, it's just the idea of this prince, American princeling, blundering around, basically not knowing what the hell he's doing, but playing with war and peace in the Middle East and saying, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Saudi Arabia, go ahead. Sure, blockade Qatar. What do you think happened? You think he just said, Dad, I'm working on this. Is that cool? Or
First of all, I think it's pretty clear they gave a green light to something. It's not exactly clear what the something they approved was. Bannon publicly in his speech said, look, it's no coincidence that you're seeing a blockade of Qatar come a couple of weeks after the Riyadh summit.
Steve Bannon talked to you for this story.
Yeah,
this is basically
yeah.
the scenario he described. It. He was quoted on the record in your piece.
Yeah, and he didn't deny it. And he was kind of playful about it. But it's not really clear. You can kind of imagine a conversation. And as best I could determine, there was a conversation that went something like, look, we want you guys, status quo in the Middle East isn't working. So let's shake it up. And so I think MBS and to a certain extent, the Emiratis said, hey, that's great. We got a little plan going for Qatar. And you could see everybody kind of light up and say, go for it, guys. And without maybe talking about it. Now, I don't know that. And that's me speculating. But I can certainly say I don't think the White House was terribly shocked when the Qatar event started happening, the blockade. Looks like maybe Saudi Arabia was going to invade Qatar. But the rest of the U.S. government was like dumbfounded. Nobody else knew. The Defense Department, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis was stunned. Tillerson was completely dumbfounded. So you had this kind of bizarre, the U.S. government is at odds with itself because the White House is kind of just doing its thing and not telling anybody. So
because Jared and his father-in-law are like Laurel and Hardy playing geopolitics.
Yeah, well, there's that.
It looks like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's that too. There's this really curious moment, like a month before the blockade. As I had mentioned, the Qatari finance minister every year comes to Manhattan. He goes to the St. Regis Hotel, rents out a big room. They take all the furniture out of it. And, you know, they're looking for places to put their money. because I have so much of it, and it's literally coming out of the ground. And so they talked to all investors. And one of the investors that came in 2017 was Charles Kushner. And he came with a plan to essentially rescue the big building on 666 Fifth Avenue that has a mortgage that's due, I think, next year. It's a mortgage of about $1.2
billion. We've talked about that a bunch of times on the show. I mean, Charles Kushner, the one who went to jail, and they're hugely underwater and facing a very tight deadline on this property that Jared massively overpaid for. And basically, they needed a bailout. So Charles Kushner goes with his son in the White House to see, who is it?
He sees the finance minister of Qatar.
The finance minister and says, would we have an investment opportunity?
Yeah, and we have a plan. Look, here's our plan to kind of turn this whole thing around. But we need $1 billion. So they asked for $1 billion with a B. And I had this very kind of animated conversation with one of the finance professionals, shall we say, who was in the room. And he said to me, we could have bought the building.
They got $1 billion.
We got the money.
Why didn't they? I mean,
it's interesting because he said, look, we tried, every which way to make that thing work. And they were like, we don't have that kind of time horizon. Like, that thing is never going to make money. It's never going to happen. It was a terrible investment. And it will always be.
But it might have been a good investment in not being invaded by Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. Yeah. And he actually said that to me. And he said, here's my question. If we had lent them $1 billion, Charles Kushner, would there have been a boycott or a blockade of Qatar? I don't think so. Raises the question. 3 weeks later, or a month later, where the Saudis and the Emiratis, with the backing of the White House, is practically at war with Qatar.
And this blockade is still going on.
Still going on. Like, I flew to Qatar from Saudi Arabia. It took me like 12 hours. And it's like down the street. I had to fly to Kuwait and then get another flight and then go to, the whole thing took like 2 days and it should have taken about an hour and a half.
And are there things in the stores? I mean, what does a blockade actually mean? Does it mean they're not getting imports?
No, it makes their life like slightly more cumbersome because this is their neighbors. But Qatar's, they've got money to burn. So they're okay. I think there was a genuine concern on the part of the Pentagon and in the State Department that the Saudis and the Emiratis were going to invade and they were going to take out the emir of Qatar, probably put in like some kind of puppet, probably take the $300 billion sovereign wealth fund. They were so concerned they put a drone up over the border to watch it. And they had to get on the phone and they had to say, like, can't do this. And I think, again, it looks like the White House gave a green light. And what's absolutely not clear is whether President Trump had any idea that the most important military base in the Middle East is in Qatar. It's Al Udeid military base. There's 10,000 American soldiers there. It's the it's the command and control center for the entire American military in the Middle East.
And Trump might just not have known that. Well, given the last person he talked to syndrome, he and Jared have been spending a lot of time talking to the Saudis and the Emiratis and getting one side of the story. And I'm sure the Saudis weren't reminding anybody of that fact.
No, and I think, apparently, as I'm told, Secretary of Defense Mattis just, he was apoplectic. We have a military base there. Like, we can't have a war in Qatar sanctioned by us, sanctioned by the United States government. It's insane. And so there's another really interesting moment, which is recounted in my piece, where I think it's midnight and it's as the blockade is beginning. There's the senior State Department official in Washington in charge of the Middle East gets a phone call from the Emirati ambassador, and he says, we're launching a blockade. And so the State Department official goes nuts and says, what are you doing? This is crazy. You can't do this. And as I'm told, the Emirati ambassador said, have you talked to the White House? We ran it past the White House.
Which is not on speaking terms with its own Secretary of State.
Oh,
at that
man.
Point.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like the White House is running that way and like the State Department's running the other and the Pentagon's. It was just, and like here we are. So again, we've got just in this very short period of time, you have Saudi Arabia trying to overthrow the government in Lebanon, Qatar creating havoc in Yemen, all of which I think is kind of directed one way, which is towards Iran, which is, the main enemy.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's pretty rocky 12 months.
Could this invasion still happen? I mean, is
of Qatar.
Yeah. I mean, is it if they think they have the backing of the White House, or have they been effectively checked by the more other parts of the defense establishment?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely now, because basically everybody woke up and said, like, what on earth is happening here? And so even I think President Trump, and you know, who knows what kind of conversation preceded this, but he had to get on the phone and say, calm down, guys.
So to the Saudis, Qatar is little Satan, but big Satan is Iran, right?
That's the main enemy.
And they're very much opposed Obama's nuclear deal with Iran,
yes.
And they've been bolstering Jared and Trump's hostility to that deal and
definitely
encouraging them to unwind it. What do they see as a positive outcome from that? I mean, they, you know, the people who support the deal say, well, this is preventing Iran from becoming a nuclear power. And if you undo the deal, they're more likely to become a nuclear power sooner. I mean, Saudi Arabia doesn't want that. What they really don't want is Iran to become a nuclear power. So what explains their opposition to the deal?
I think it's broader than just the deal itself. When they look at the map, they say, look, Lebanon, that's an Iranian base. Syria, taken over by the Iranians. Iraq, where the United States spent so much money and lives, that's essentially controlled by the Iraqis. By the Iranians. And Yemen, now the Iranians are in Yemen. And so the Saudis feel like they're being encircled. And so they really, I mean, it's to them, this is an existential threat. The Crown Prince has been very explicit about this. He said the ideology of the Iranian Revolution is very similar to that of the Nazis, and they're coming after us, and they want to take over Saudi Arabia. And so they see it as a kind of fight to the death. And so as to the nuclear deal, to me, it begs the question, because if you put the deal aside, you have to ask, are you ready to go to war? You know, and I think, you know, that's where we come in.
I know the Saudis pay for pretty high-priced PR, but I'm not sure they're getting great advice by saying that the Iranians are worse than the Nazis and worse than Hitler. This is a recurring theme of theirs, and it seems a little hyperbolic.
Kind of. I think they believe it. I sat with Thamer Saban, who's the minister for Gulf Affairs, at his farmhouse outside of Riyadh, and he went on and on about the Nazis and the Persians. And so, you know, this is for
then
them.
He gave you some very large dates.
yes. And fortunately, it wasn't the Saudi summer. But I think they feel empowered, and they have felt empowered by Trump and by Kushner, because everybody's on the same page. And even when you take the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, into which MBS has also inserted himself, that's like, let's ram something down the Palestinians' throat. Let's get them to take this deal, take it or leave it. We'll tie that up. And then that, with that done, we'll have Israel and the whole Arab world will form a united front against Iran to contain them. And I think that's kind of, that's the playbook that both the Saudis and the White House are kind of looking at right now.
And the Saudis would accept peace with Israel as a price of that, right? If they can check Iran, because they seem to be strangely supportive of these moves, like moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and these, you know, very pro-Israel things that Kushner and Trump want to do. They're okay with that. That's not their agenda. They've got a different agenda.
It's
a bargaining chip.
It's amazing. I mean, the number of people who said to me, MBS couldn't care less about Jerusalem, couldn't care less about the Palestinians. If, in fact, I mean, he really took this peace plan to the Palestinian leadership. And I mean, it's Jerusalem's off the table. All the settlements in the West Bank are ratified. Very limited autonomy for the Palestinians. I mean, the only place you can find a deal like that is like on the rightward fringe of in Israel. And here you have the leader of the largest economy in the Middle East carrying that water for the White House to do that. It's amazing.
And Dexter, how does Syria figure in all this? I mean, what do the Saudis think about Syria?
I think when the Saudis look at Syria, they see another country lost to the Iranians. And so it's part of this kind of sphere of Iranian influence that stretches basically from the Mediterranean, Lebanon with Hezbollah, all the way back to the Iranian border with Iraq. And Syria is like a piece of that. And so as this person on the National Security Council said to me, we looked at the northern tier of the Middle East is basically lost. It's lost to the Iranians. And I think the Saudis see it that way, too.
Does Saudi Arabia think they've lost Lebanon? Because you describe in your piece this weird episode when Saad Hariri, the Lebanese prime minister, was basically kidnapped. And according to your reporting, he was being held by the Saudis and slapped around like they were actually slapping his face, convincing him to do what they wanted. And what they want is for him to be a stronger anti-Hezbollah, in effect, anti-Iranian proxy figure.
Or to get out of the way.
Yeah.
I think there was a plan to bring his brother in. But yeah, I mean, it was absolutely shocking. They essentially took a sitting prime minister of another country, put him in a room and said, quit. And here's your speech. Go out and read it on television. And he did. And I think when the Saudis look at Lebanon, they see, look, we've been pouring money into this country for years. And the most powerful actor in the country by far, political party and military force, is Hezbollah, which is, you know, our mortal enemy. It's essentially an arm of the Iranian government. Yeah, we're not getting anything out of this.
But do they think they can overturn Hezbollah in Lebanon, even if they can't check Iran's influence in Syria?
I think the sort of grabbing onto Hariri and dragging him back to Riyadh and forcing him to resign, or trying to force him to resign, that was just a measure of how frustrated they are. I don't think there are any good options for them. Hezbollah is too strong. It's too late for that. They got to be reckoned with.
So what's the – you've spent decades, Dexter, covering the Middle East. You know, whenever I read your work or other in-depth stories about it, I just come away thinking – this is so complicated, the people immersed in it barely understand it. And then you think what happens to people who, you know, are kind of clueless about it. It's what happened to the Bush administration, right? You can blunder into something you don't understand. Is that the big concern about the Trump administration, that they're just in so far over their heads that they could blunder into war, they could blunder into creating a catastrophe without having any idea what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean— you know, Jared, I think, said at one point publicly, and he was talking about the Israel-Palestine problem. He said, look, I don't care about the past. And I mean, and to say that in the Middle East is it's shocking. I mean, the past is all there is. You know, history is everywhere. It's in the room. And, you know, the memories there go back 1,000 years or more. And you can't think like that. And my concern now is that you have, instead of having people in the U.S. government like, say, Tillerson and Mattis, Mattis is still there, and H.R. McMaster, now it's John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. And so I think, if anything, MBS is going to feel like he can be even more aggressive in the region, or more aggressive in particular towards the Iranians. And so I think we're probably in for a pretty rough ride.
Because basically there's no really responsible authority to check something they do that might be really radical.
Well, I mean, I think those guys have been very clear in the White House. They've been very clear about confronting the Iranians, pushing the Iranians back. The number of people who use the phrase to me, you know, in the White House and in the administration, we are going to roll back the Iranians in the Middle East, roll back. I mean, I heard that a half dozen times talking to people. And, you know, good luck, but, you know, that's a little scary. You know, I hope they know what they're in for.
Yeah, it's not just, it'd be great to roll back the Iranians. The question is, what gets rolled over when you roll them back?
Exactly. And how do they respond as well? Yeah, yeah.
I've been speaking with Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker. Dexter, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks so much.
That's it for today's show. Trumpcast was produced by Jason DeLeon. I am really excited about this Slow Burn live show that's going to happen on April 19th at 7 p.m. on Lexington Avenue in New York. Leon Nafok is going to host Bob Woodward and Virginia Heffernan and other guests. It's going to be a really interesting conversation about Watergate and its implications for the present day. You can get tickets at slate.com/live. That's slate.com/live. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.